Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, will the U.S. government shut down on Donald Trump's 100th day in office?
Can you, from that podium, guarantee that there will not be a government shutdown?
I can't guarantee.
U.S. senators will get a rare briefing at the White House on the North Korea threat. Former President Barack Obama makes his first public appearance since leaving office.
Our parties have moved further and further apart, and it's harder and harder to find common ground.
Breaking the stigma of struggling with mental health issues. Also ahead, a film our movie reviewer says is one of the best. It's all on today's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. Well, the House of Representatives has just a few days to finish negotiating a 2017 budget. If no agreement is reached on levels of funding, the U.S. government will shut down at midnight on April 28th. A main sticking point is President Trump's call for inclusion of money for construction of a wall along the Mexican border that Democrats say they're against. At his daily briefing, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked how likely the chances actually are of a government shutdown.
They are currently negotiating. We feel very confident that they understand the president's priorities and that we'll come to an agreement by the end of Friday.
While Trump vowed during his run for the White House to build a barrier along the southern border and make Mexico pay for it, something Mexican leaders say will not happen. Many lawmakers have concerns about the cost of a border wall, which has been estimated between $21 and $70 billion. Joining me now is Daniel Lipman, co-author of Politico's Playbook. Daniel, first of all, can you explain to us more about why the government could shut down?
Without a continuing resolution to fund the government next week, then most of the government would shut down except for things that are vital to national security. And so because the government is operating on these kind of year-to-year budgets, they really need to strike a deal in the next few days or, the government will just grind to a halt.
The White House is pretty much demanding money for the border wall with Mexico to get Democrats to go along with paying for the wall in the budget in order to keep the government from being shut down. The Democrats are vowing they will not do that. Would he be able to actually follow through with that?
The Trump White House has offered Democrats a dollar for spending on Obamacare subsidies in exchange for funding a dollar of the border wall. But Democrats have shown no indication that they're interested in that. And it looks like Republicans on the Hill do not share the White House's position about funding for the border wall. They say they should fight it another day. They should just fund the government in a clean way.
So what you're saying is Republicans are not in favor of threats over paying for the wall?
They just want to fund the government in a clean way, mm-hmm. and they don't want to have the potential of it shutting down because of funding for the border wall. They don't want to spend billions of dollars on this thing in the first place. And
right.
If they have to, then they don't want to have the government shut down in case it can't pass on the Hill.
And my understanding is that the part about Obamacare, health care, is that the White House is threatening to cut off funding, saying that without it, Obamacare will die sooner and faster by threatening to defund subsidies in this budget?
He definitely can try to do that, but I think Trump realizes that he would be blamed if millions of people can't get health insurance through the federal government because he's not funding the exchanges and the subsidies. And so far we haven't seen them go down that path of not funding them. It seems like it's a negotiating chip. But it's a really tricky political balance for him because he doesn't want to be held accountable if those exchanges fail.
Is the wall money the only sticking point here as far as the budget goes?
Yeah, there's no other major issues that are holding them up besides the border wall. So basically, Republicans in the next couple of days will probably relent and they will come together and pass a somewhat clean government funding bill, and then government will stay open. And then Trump will sign that. That's just what people on the Hill are telling us.
Because otherwise, if there is a government shutdown in the first 100 days of a new presidency, I would imagine that wouldn't be too good for Donald Trump politically.
No, he doesn't not. He's already struggling with how many successes he's actually had in his first 100 days. And so he doesn't want to have that be the capstone And it would ironically happen on his 100th day. And so he is desperate to avoid that because it would overshadow everything that he's actually done.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Daniel Lipman, he is the co-author of Politico's Playbook. Well, speaking of presidents, former U.S. President Barack Obama returned to public life on Monday, urging young people in his adopted hometown of Chicago to be activists in their communities, much like he was before running for political office. The 44th U.S. president moderated a panel of young people made up of a high school and college students, along with recent graduates. Obama saying, "Pressing problems of income inequality, climate change, and unfairness in the criminal justice system are serious. They're daunting, but they're not unsolvable."
I have to say that there's a reason why I'm always optimistic, even when things look like they're sometimes not going the way I want, and that is because of young people like this. And it gives you, I think, a sense of what's possible for this country. My hope is that working with young leaders like this, the organizations that and universities and high schools and nonprofit organizations and community groups that are getting them engaged, that my foundation and Presidential Center will be able to provide more and more pathways for young people to getting involved, so that when somebody like me 35 years ago decides that I've got something to contribute, that there we will have eased the path a little bit for them.
All right. Well, as you might imagine, social media was quite a buzz on Monday following Obama's first public appearance since leaving office. Andrew Palcheski is here now joining us with more on that part of the story. So, Andrew, sounds like there were some comments that Obama made that did go viral.
Immediately after he gets in this huge applause, sits down, he says, "So what's been going on while I've been gone?" And that gets a bunch of laughs from the audience. Another viral moment, one of the student leaders there is talking about how he studied Obama's campaign in middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama says, "Let me stop you there for a second." He says, "Can I just say, I'm old." So he got a few laughs with that. But he actually had some things to say about social media. He was talking about how we consume media and how it contributes to partisanship. And he says that with social media and media as a whole, we tend to focus on people that agree with us. We don't tend to cross-pollinate ideas. So it makes us more partisan. He says if you're liberal, then you're on the liberal news sites. If you're conservative, you're on the conservative news sites, or whatever you're choosing. And mm-hmm. then he said, or maybe you're just looking at cat videos, which is fine. So he did make a little bit of a joke there. But
he's got a good sense of humor.
He does have a good sense of humor, but there was a serious message there that we need to maybe look at a whole comprehensive group of different news sources, not just the ones that we agree with politically.
Okay.
As far as social media trending around this, these remarks, a lot of people saying that they miss President Obama, saying that they want him to come back. Others saying, get over it, he's not the president anymore. So even the partisanship there we're seeing among his remarks. But generally well-received. It was for a good cause, which is trying to spur civic engagement among young people.
Excellent. Anything else going on?
Big news for Instagram. The photo app was down today across the world. People trying to use the app and found their photos would not load.
Oh.
So what is, of course, the first thing you do when your Instagram doesn't work, you go to another social media network and you start tweeting or posting about it. So on
right.
Twitter, on Facebook, all kinds of social networks, people freaking out that Instagram was not working. I think my favorite meme out of this was a photo of a man screaming into a cell phone and it says in text, "Instagram is down. Just describe your lunch for me." Because, of course, everybody's taking pictures of their food on Instagram, posting it, whether it's their lunch or what they're cooking.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So that was, I thought, rather funny. People did calm down. The good news is it did come back up. The funny thing, though, is it was only down for about an hour. But yet the freak out because of this was so great, despite the fact that it was only down for an hour. I have to say that I went and checked my Instagram feed when it was down, not knowing it was down, and I just assumed I had bad cell service mm-hmm. or web service, so I just closed it out and said, I'll check it later, no big deal. But for people who are really into Instagram, it was a problem for them today. But thankfully, it is back up functioning. No word from Instagram
Thank
why
goodness,
it was down.
The world will go
the
on.
The world can continue spinning. No word from Instagram why it shut down, but we'll have to monitor that and see if they come out with a statement.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. hits hundreds of Syrian tech workers with new sanctions. U.S. and China to launch four rounds of talks as Trump looks forward to a Beijing visit. Kenya, Ghana, Malawi chosen for breakthrough malaria vaccine trial. And a former East German plans Tear Down This Wall concert on the U.S.-Mexico border. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. This is International Edition. Well, all 100 U.S. senators have been invited to the White House on Wednesday for a classified briefing that will primarily concern North Korea, the administration announcing on Monday. Now, while lawmakers often receive classified briefings on Capitol Hill, it's rare for them to take place at the White House and for the entire Senate to be involved in one event. President Trump and U.S. officials have repeatedly said all options remain on the table to deal with further North Korean provocations. The North on Tuesday will celebrate the anniversary of the founding of its military, which is a key holiday in that country. And there are concerns that Pyongyang, in conjunction with the anniversary, will demonstrate a show of force by possibly firing more ballistic missiles or conducting a sixth nuclear test. Meanwhile, a third U.S. citizen was detained Friday by North Korean authorities as he was about to leave the country. State Department spokesman Mark Toner told reporters he's not aware of any contact with the American.
As far as I know, we have not gained access to the individual in question.
At least two other U.S. citizens are known to be held in North Korea. The U.S. and North Korea have never had diplomatic ties. Sweden's embassy in Pyongyang represents the interests of American citizens in that country. Well, North Korea does have a pattern, though, of detaining and sentencing American visitors to prison in order to get high-profile visitors to go there to obtain their release. Joining me now, though, is journalist Bruce Harrison in Seoul, South Korea. Thank you for being with us. So how much can the U.S. really do, and what will it do about this American's arrest?
It may take a backseat compared to what's happening regarding military assets in the region, both North Korea and the United States. I'm specifically referring to the USS Carl Vinson. I don't know if detaining this man, Tony Kim, is North Korea trying to grab some leverage in this situation, saying we've got another American. Mm-hmm. Apparently there are three there being detained now. This case could be completely unrelated to the tensions right now, and I don't think North Korea would be able to really leverage this capture in the face of the current threats it's facing from the U.S. government.
And certainly, though, you know, the U.S. has issued many, many warnings for U.S. citizens not to go to North Korea.
Constantly, but banning U.S. travel there. And I don't believe North Korea has done that either. And it's something you just take, it's risk you take into your own hands. And there are plenty of tour companies that are advertising through this period of tensions as if it's still a great place to travel and we're going to get you the best deal. We're going to get you there through China and we'll show you the DPRK. Tensions aren't as high as they have been in the past few years. I believe 2013 there was a higher peak, and then the fall of 2015 too arguably was higher when there was significant action along the border. The loudspeaker games were going on and each side dropped a little bit of artillery across the border. That's not happening, and I've heard from a lot of analysts that a border skirmish is really kind of a scarier standoff than what we have going on right now.
President Trump has dispatched the Naval Strike Group to the waters off of the Korean Peninsula. We had heard several weeks ago that it was actually already in the area or on its way, and now it's apparently now actually on its way and will be there within a few days. North Korea already saying it's ready to sink the aircraft carrier. That's a pretty threatening thing to say. How serious do you think that North Korea is, or is this just more bluster and rhetoric?
Great question. There's two parts to it, I think. First, North Korea's military capabilities. Could you strike a major nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, you know, off its east coast with conventional military weapons? Possibly. I don't know what kind of anti-missile deterrence that carrier strike group has, but I'm sure it could handle conventional military weapons. So then we look to the recent birthday anniversary of Kim Il-sung and North Korea showing off its new weapons technology, and analysts picking apart the missiles on the backs of these trucks being driven through Pyongyang, trying to determine whether or not North Korea has the capability to put a nuclear weapon on a guided ballistic missile. Most say they're still not there, but they're closer to having an intercontinental ballistic missile, or even just the technology to launch a nuke. And I think that's what North Korea was implying through its statement, that it could nuke the USS Carl Vinson and destroy it in one strike. So maybe it's a bit of bluster in the sense that I don't think they necessarily have the capability yet to destroy it, as they said. Number two, they'd be willing to do that and deal with the consequences, which would most likely be retaliation by the U.S. There's a lot of analysts talking these days about North Korea's potential to go on the offensive and how incidents over the past 34 years show that the theory of victory, as some call it, is, you know, the survival of the regime, and they're willing at all costs to maintain that. So that doesn't necessarily mean waiting for a strike. It means maybe perhaps using their weaponry first if they truly feel threatened. I know I'm going on here for a bit, but I think people like to downplay the thought that North Korea would ever strike first, because it would mean certain annihilation for the country, considering the massive firepower that its neighbor and the U.S. and other allies in the region have. But I think you push North Korea harder, and you may see them lashing out first in an attempt to stop something before it happens.
The people that you speak to in South Korea, do they just go about their business and this is just normal stuff for them because they've been hearing about it for so long, or are people concerned?
I think people were more concerned this time. The situation is still ongoing. But that week leading up to Vice President Mike Pence's visit, when we really thought the U.S. Carl Vinson was heading to the area, public sentiment here was a bit more rattled. I've talked to young Koreans. They don't think a war is going to happen because they've grown up entirely with the specter of war hanging above their head, and it's never happened. And some of them even told me that Trump uses strong language, but they don't think he's going to bring about a real crisis in East Asia, so they're not worried that much. Then you talk to people that are a bit older, and they're saying, of course, I'm concerned about military conflict. They are concerned that many young people or other Koreans have just become so used to this cycle of escalating and de-escalating tensions that they don't believe it's possible for something bad to happen. There is reason to believe that this stalemate can't last forever, and either there's going to be some sort of peace treaty or there's going to be some sort of violent conflict.
All right, Seoul, Korea-based journalist Bruce Harrison, thanks for being with us. Well, U.S. astronaut Peggy Whitson on Monday broke the record for most accumulated time spent in orbit by an American. Commander Whitson, who is aboard the International Space Station, was congratulated by U.S. President Donald Trump, who spoke to space station astronauts via video.
534 days and counting. That's an incredible record to break. And on behalf of our nation and, frankly, on behalf of the world, I'd like to congratulate you. That is really something.
Well, the 57-year-old Whitson is the most experienced U.S. spacewoman. She's scheduled to return to Earth in September, at which time she'll have 666 days in space over the course of three flights. The two also discussed the potential for further space travel, including to Mars, which NASA has said it wants to accomplish by the 2030s. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Britain's Prince Harry recently disclosed that he had to seek mental health counseling after dealing with several years of, quote, chaos. He says he struggled in his late 20s with unresolved emotional issues after not coping well with the untimely death of his mother, Princess Diana, when he was 12. And the young royal has now formed an organization that works to break the stigma of mental health issues. It's something that gets attention when someone so well-known speaks out about a very private struggle. And many people have wondered how he and his brother, Prince William, really got through that tragedy in their young lives. But there are millions of people here in the U.S. and around the world who suffer in silence for fear of embarrassment about their own mental health struggles. Joining me now is Catherine Switz, CEO and founder of the Stability Network, a coalition of people speaking out about their mental health conditions to help break the stigma. Thank you for being with us. So what do you think about Prince Harry, what he's doing?
I think it's extremely important and exciting. And I think the main message is simply that mental health conditions are incredibly prevalent. They can even affect somebody like Prince Harry, but that treatment works and treatment is possible. And he himself made the choice to go and get care. And that's really what we're trying to convey.
My understanding is there are many, many, many Americans alone, not to mention the rest of the world, that are dealing with mental health issues. And I think that when you tell someone you have a physical problem, they can relate. But that's not always the case when it comes to mental health, is it?
That's exactly right. And 1 in 5 people in any given year experience a mental health condition. And it is just as prevalent as many other illnesses that we hear about more often, and is also as treatable.
Can you give me a brief history about how you got involved in all this?
Sure. I had my first psychotic break at Harvard Business School, and my mom gave me a book called An Unquiet Mind about a woman who recovers from a psychotic break. And if you can believe it, at the time in the hospital, the Harvard doctors told me, we don't know if you're going to get better. We don't know if you're going to be able to go back to school. But I had this book that gave me hope and insight into the fact that I could, in fact, recover and go on to a demanding career. And as I started to stabilize about 10 years later, I realized that people like me who have a stable husband and a strong career had to speak out so that all those others could get care as well.
Do you think it's becoming less of a stigma here in the United States, or do you think we still have a long way to go?
I think we have a long way to go still. I think it is becoming a bit more normal, and it's wonderful to have celebrities and people like Prince Harry speaking out, but I think it takes more of us speaking out, and that's really what the Stability Network is about. We're about a coalition of people in the workforce speaking out about our own mental health conditions, because the notion is that as soon as other people know somebody in their immediate network that has a given condition, that stigma goes down, and that's what we're aiming to do.
What advice would you give people out there that are struggling in silence and probably could use some help?
We ask that people seek care. Treatment can work, and it's so important that people seek the care they need. Support others in your network to get the care that they need. And if you're a professional living with a mental health condition and you're willing to speak out, we ask that you join us in speaking out and paving the way for others to get better.
All right, Catherine Switz, CEO and founder of the Stability Network. Thank you. And now we turn to the latest movie trends in the United States, and joining us for that is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, The Promise, that was initially made to raise awareness around a global event that many know nothing about, really, but it didn't do too well at the box office over the weekend for its opening day. Now, this is despite big celebrities like Kim Kardashian West and Cher promoting the film. Now, it's too bad since all the proceeds of the film will be donated to nonprofits. But you saw it and you loved it?
The Promise is not only an epic film that takes place at the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1915, but it also shows about the Armenian genocide. And this movie is produced by Kirk Kerkorian, who's a very well-established Las Vegan who started MGM Hotels. And he passed away a couple of years ago, but he financed a $100 million budget for this movie because he's an Armenian-American. And the movie stars Oscar Isaacs, who's a medical student who's going to Constantinople to learn his craft when he's caught up in the Turkish Revolution. Not many Americans understand the Armenian genocide, and I only learned about this last year for the first time. And it's the extermination, really, the ethnic cleansing of Christian Armenians out of Turkey. Millions were killed. This was all during when World War I was happening, too. So there was a whole kind of news lockout. And in the film, Christian Bale plays an American journalist who's on the forefront of all of this tragedies that are going on, where villages are being destroyed and children and families are being killed. It's just a real eye-opening epic in every sense. I think it's one of the best films that I've seen in years. I'm not going to forget it come award time. And when I say an epic movie, this is like an Armenian Schindler's List. It is on the scale of Dr. Zhivago. It is that grandiose, but it also has a hard-hitting message and some real graphic scenes. But you know what? You can't forget these tragedies because they happen again. You know, Hitler started 15 years later in Bosnia or Hotel Rwanda, the same director who did Hotel Rwanda. So The Promise, not only is it exceptional filmmaking, but the story and the message are more important than ever.
For sure. Very timely. What about Their Finest? We've got a good old-fashioned war movie?
We do. It's a World War II movie. It's a comedy. It stars Gemma Amerton, who, along with Bill Nighy, she's a woman who's in her mid-20s, and she's trying to survive in war-torn London. And she's hired by the War Department to write screenplays for propaganda films. And they're doing one specific propaganda film where it's trying to bring the country together. It's trying to bring the Americans into the war effort. She falls in love with a screenwriter. So it's a romantic movie, but it's also a war movie. And so the movie does jump around from being a romantic comedy. And also it reminds you that war is hell. You know, people die and friends die. And so it kind of brings you back to that reality. Again, it's one of my favorite movies of the year so far. And I just love this film. I really do. And it's an import from London, all the way from England. So it's got a real authenticity to it. And it's a wartime tale that I think a lot of people are going to enjoy.
Jeffrey K. Howard. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vice President Mike Pence visited Indonesia in mid-April as part of a tour of allies of the United States in the East Asia and Pacific region. During a joint press conference with Indonesia's President Joko Widodo, Vice President Pence said that his visit is an indication of the high value the United States places on the two countries' strategic partnership. As the second and third largest democracies in the world, our two countries share many common values, including freedom, the rule of law, human rights, and religious diversity, said Vice President Pence. The United States is proud to partner with Indonesia to promote and protect these values, the birthright of all people. The United States is one of Indonesia's oldest and most engaged defense partners, said Vice President Pence, and we are firmly committed to continuing this collaboration. The strong relationship between our two countries will help us successfully confront the various security threats that we now face, including one of the greatest challenges we both must contend with, the rise and spread of terrorism. At the same time, said Vice President Pence, the United States will uphold the fundamental freedoms of navigation and overflight in the South China Sea and throughout the Asia Pacific. Will ensure the unimpeded flow of lawful commerce and promote peaceful diplomatic dialogue to address issues of regional and global concern. But that does not mean that we cannot improve on our relationship, said Vice President Pence, noting that the United States seeks trade relationships that are both free and fair. This means creating a level playing field to ensure that American businesses can fully participate in the Indonesia market, a privilege that Indonesia exporters that do business in the United States have enjoyed for many years. What we are looking for is a win-win relationship. I have the privilege of reaffirming the United States' strategic partnership with Indonesia and declaring our commitment to strengthen our bonds of friendship, commerce, and security, said Vice President Pence. Through our continued partnership, the United States and Indonesia will continue to maintain a peaceful, stable, and prosperous Southeast Asia for the benefit of both of our nations and for the benefit of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.